First, just by means of introduction, so you know some of who I am. My name's Dr. Lucas Engelhardt. I actually prefer professor to doctor. The whole reason I got my doctorate was to be a professor. So whatever, I'm not that picky. If you've introduced yourself to me, I've probably slipped and called myself Lucas. I've been used to being called that my whole life, so that's fine too. So whatever you want to call me, I'll answer. Probably, hey, you works as well. All right. So the topic for my talk today, as you know if you've looked at the schedule, I'm kind of puzzled as to why you're here instead of upstairs. It's market for security. Come on, guys. You're here to learn more about errors, business cycles, and government stimulus, which apparently is a stimulating topic to you. So I guess we can't judge preferences. They are subjective after all. So what I'm hoping to do today is kind of give some more argument in the any business cycle theory, this is true of the Austrian, true of any business cycle theory, relies ultimately on the possibility for entrepreneurs to make errors, and to make errors in a very systematic way over the course of the business cycle. So I'll build up that argument first, and then we'll take this and add to it the Austrian conception of capital to make what I think is a very strong argument against government stimulating the economy in the case of a recession. And in fact, the fact that we made errors early on proves that it's a very bad idea for us to try to cover these errors up with government stimulus. So let's go ahead and launch into things. I actually kind of think of this lecture as being in some way a sequel to what Dr. Garrison did yesterday afternoon. And I'm kind of following up and detailing some things that he did there. Although this is probably a bad way to think of the lecture, because as we all know, sequels are terrible. So we'll see what happens. All right. So following in Dr. Garrison's footsteps, I did not make a PowerPoint presentation. I'm not that good with computer animation, but I will provide animation and sound effects using this sheet of paper for you. So we're going to look at just at the most basic level, what does a business cycle look like? Well, we have something on the vertical axis. We'll detail that in a second. Time running across the horizontal. And what do we have? We start out with some level of something, right? Then we hit the boom, things start going up. Right. Then eventually we hit a crisis point where, oh no, we're realizing we've made a bunch of errors, things are bad, and therefore we have a correction or the bust. And you're a crash, right? There we go. All right. So at the most basic level, this is kind of what a business cycle looks like. Something is going up and that something is falling back down. But I've not labeled this vertical axis. The reason being, there's lots of things we could put there, and the graph would still be accurate. We could, say, put employment there. Most of the time, maybe not all the time, but most of the time during the boom, we have more people employed. During the bust, lots of people get laid off. So we have employment fall. We could also put something like the standard Keynesian measures of output. We will often see, say, GDP will rise during the boom and fall during the recession, during the bust. Or we could also put here, stock prices tend to follow the same pattern. Right? During the boom, stock prices go up, and during the bust, they fall. I'm just going to appeal, for the sake of my argument, to what is probably the most recent case here in the U.S., housing being kind of the locus of where a lot of the most recent boom happened. So housing prices followed this pattern. Now, this is one where if I were a hardcore empiricist, I would have made a PowerPoint slide and shown you like the Case-Shiller home price index. It ends up, though, that my graph here is a remarkably good representation of what it looks like starting in about 2000 and ending right around now. It looks, in fact, almost exactly like this in terms of its shape. So that's basically what business cycles look like. And I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that point. See, things are good and then things are bad. So why is it that error is such an important part of explaining this pattern that we see, say, in housing prices? The key is right up here, right at the peak. I always get nervous whenever I draw a graph. I think this is true of, I think, any good Austrian. When you start drawing graphs, you start kind of feeling on edge. The reason being, not that the graph is inaccurate. We do know that if we were to graph housing prices, we can observe those, right? We can actually measure them, we can put them on a graph across time, we can see these things. So it's not this is an inaccurate thing, but it's that far too often when we put things on a graph, we start forgetting the real story of what's actually going on, and we start thinking the story is actually about the graph, or even worse, that the graph is the story. But that's not true. This graph came from somewhere. Housing prices mean something. So what is a price? Any price is really an exchange ratio. It's people giving up money to get some good. In this case, the good being some quantity of housing. So that's really the true story. Some people are out there wanting to buy houses. They're paying this money. That's the price that we're graphing here on our vertical axis. And other people are willing to accept that money in exchange for the house they're selling. Now, when we think about it this way, we need to say, well, let's suppose that nobody makes errors. And all we really need for that is, all we really need, this understatement, is what we call perfect foresight. That is, everybody understands what the future is going to hold. So is this pattern of housing prices consistent with the idea of perfect foresight? Like, could we have exchanges happening at this very high housing price at the peak? Let's say, where I come from, $250,000 is a pretty high price for a home. It's going to buy you a reasonably good upper-middle-class home. Probably not as true in California, but okay. I'm in northeast Ohio. So $250,000, say, is a relatively high price for the home we're dealing with here. Now, is it consistent with perfect foresight to have a buyer and a seller arriving at this price knowing that in the next few months housing prices are going to collapse? Well, from the seller's perspective, certainly. I'd happily accept this $250,000 rather than the $200,000 I'm going to get in a few months. From the buyer's standpoint, though, this is absolute nonsense. There's no reason that I would pay $250,000 when if I wait a month or two, I can pay significantly less. I can get exactly the same good for a much lower price. That's what I would do. So, if we have perfect foresight, we're not going to end up with this peak happening. We're not actually going to observe this price that we can put on our graph. Right? So, in essence, what's going to happen is that our buyers start backing out of the market, and that keeps prices from rising to that level. So, say we could draw the graph again. I'm not going to, but let's just cut off the peak. So we do something like this. Right? So instead, we have this rise, then a plateau, and then a collapse. Well, here we have the same problem. It's just moved to a different point. Right here. Does it make sense for me to pay, say, $200,000 for this home, knowing that in a few months it'll be worth $150,000, and I could pick it up at that price? Well, once again, no. So, in fact, if we keep following perfect foresight to its logical conclusion, we can't actually have a point where there's a dramatic decrease in the value of homes. So we could have, I think that there are three paths that might be consistent with perfect foresight. We could have, say, things that are perfectly stable. That's possible. This would be housing prices again. Or we might possibly, under some conditions, it's imaginable that housing prices might gradually increase. Or it might also be imaginable that they would gradually decrease. I think actually the case for a gradual decrease is somewhat stronger, because then we can appeal to things like time preference. Okay, I'm willing to buy a house that's going to lose a little bit of value because I want to have the house now. So these things might possibly happen. But we know, just from observing housing prices over the past 10 years, that that's not what we see. We actually see something that looks virtually exactly like this. Which tells us, right, we can't have perfect foresight. There's no way. There's no way perfect foresight can be true. Well, the only alternative to perfect foresight is that there's some possibility for people to make errors. That's it. So if we're going to have a business cycle, we need to have error as part of the story. It's an essential part. So then the question is, how do we get errors into the story? Now here I think probably at the moment the most common mainstream answer to this, one thing I'll note is that the story I just told is not a specifically Austrian story. In fact, when I went to graduate school, I went to a very mainstream program at Ohio State. I managed to survive it because I enjoy math games. That's what it was. Okay. Right, so there we have learned an argument almost exactly like this as to why we can't have bubbles. It's exactly the same argument. It doesn't make sense at the peak for people with perfect foresight to go ahead and buy the thing anyway. Right, so we have to have some kind of stability. So then, how is it that we do actually see in reality these business cycle types of patterns? I think the most common explanation, weirdly enough, from the mainstream comes in the form of rational expectations. Rational expectations is, the way that it feels is that it's only a small step from perfect foresight, but But it's a small step that gets us everything we need in terms of allowing error. So rational expectations tells us that people, when they think about what's going to happen in the future, they look at all the data that they have, all the data that not just they have, but that is possibly relevant and that is available to anybody, they look at all of this data, and they form expectations the best that they can about the future. Now, the reality is, according to rational expectations, that there are some things that are just random that we can't actually predict. So the best thing we can do is make a reasonable guess based on historical experience, say. And we know, okay, so do we know that housing prices, say at this point, do we know that they're going to fall in the future? Well, no. There's some odds they're going to go up, some odds they're going to go down. Looking at market conditions, there's uncertainty here. So it might be reasonable for us to go ahead and buy this house because we don't know that the price is going to fall. So when we think about it this way, one of the things that happened during the most recent bust, because it was just so severe, everybody was very upset with mainstream macroeconomics. Because mainstream macroeconomics didn't see it coming. But it ends up that one of the great champions of rational expectations, Robert Lucas, came out and said, oh no, this proves that we're right. Because rational expectations tells us if things are going to turn down, it's not possible for us to have seen it coming. Right? If we'd seen it coming, things wouldn't have collapsed in the first place. Right? So it's absolutely bizarre that we see in this great justification for our theory. Oh, this is a totally random thing. It's an event that's such a low probability that nobody's gonna think it's going to happen. But it's a high enough probability that it might happen. And it did. Oh. If you flip a coin 100 times, it might show up heads every time. And that's just what happened during this housing bust. Sorry, but there's no way we could have seen it coming. I think, while it may be true that many mainstream economists find this to be a convincing argument, somehow, most people don't find this to be satisfying. We often draw analogies, and I, once again, get nervous drawing analogies, but let's go ahead and accept this one. We think about this kind of like with meteorology. So we watch the weather, and we're predicting what the weather's going to be like the next day. Now, we don't get upset with the weatherman if he's off in what the high temperature's going to be by a couple degrees. Okay, we understand there's uncertainty involved. You might get things a little bit wrong. We get very upset if we end up with a hurricane here in our hometown that the weatherman didn't tell us about. This is a huge event we should have seen coming. Right. Similarly, I think with the most recent bust, this is a huge event. We should have seen it coming. There should have been signs somewhere. Yet, we have Robert Lucas saying, no, no, rational expectations, low probability event. No way we could have seen it coming. It's not satisfying. Now, it ends up, though, that it's not true that nobody saw it coming. You know, being in this room, I'm sure that a significant number of you, if not the majority or maybe all, have seen on YouTube the video Peter Schiff was right. We know, right? Peter Schiff, he's a financial guy. I'm very informed by the Austrian School of Economics and our view of the business cycle. And early on in the housing bubble, he said, no, this is a bubble. It's going to collapse. And he got the timing very close to right. And he told the story before it happened as to what was going to happen. So is it possible that Robert Lucas is right? And that, oh, there's no way anybody could have seen this coming. Oh, no, Peter Schiff saw it. Mark Faber saw it. These financial guys informed by the Austrian school. We also have, say, Mark Thornton here saw it coming, right, informed by the Austrian school. So maybe the Austrian school has something to say that allows us to predict the course of the business cycle. But then there's a challenge. If the Austrian school can predict the course of the business cycle, why aren't we trapped in this perfect foresight argument again? Why is it entrepreneurs don't all just say, well, we've watched the Austrians, they were right time and time again. Peter Schiff, for example, is right time and time again. Why don't we just adjust for what these people are saying? So there we actually need, if we're going to defend the Austrian business cycle theory, I think it's helpful for us to have a theory of how these errors happen. Despite the fact that most of the time, entrepreneurs are very, very good at foresight. Not perfect, but very good at it. So why is it that they get things so, so wrong over the course of the business cycle? Okay. So here I think there are actually a number of explanations. None of these really have the nature of economic law that, say, the law of diminishing marginal utility does, or the law of demand, the law of supply. But these are all things that we can deduce from human action. We can be perfectly sure about these. Each of these explanations I'm going to offer is somewhat speculative, they don't follow necessarily from the reality of human action, but they do provide potential explanations. So one possible explanation comes from, I'm not sure that he originated it, but Dr. Block advocates this idea that the low interest rate is in effect a bribe. So bribes entrepreneurs to err. Right, so here we take into account this idea that people respond to the incentives they're given. Even if maybe they know that they're taking more risks, in this case, entrepreneurs also know that the interest rate is low, and that's a greater certainty for them. Interest rate is certainly low, so we may as well take advantage of it. It's kind of the argument here. And that leads to, as we know from Dr. Garrison, distortions in the capital structure. What type of investment makes sense when interest rates are low? Well, those are very early stages of production. So we start building up these types of businesses. I think a good analogy here to really get at what this argument is saying is to imagine what would happen if, say, the government decided to offer subsidies for the production of lead baseballs. Lead baseballs have very little consumer value, I would guess. Probably. But if the government offers a subsidy, we might have some people that say, well, it might make sense, at least for me, to take the government's money and set up production to do this. So we start training workers in the production of lead baseballs. We start building factories, all designed toward the production of lead baseballs. But then down the road, the government removes this subsidy. And we find out, oh, we made a horrible mistake. Right? We shouldn't have built this. There's no way we can sell this product in a way that's profitable. Similarly, we could say the same thing with low interest rates. And that's basically what this argument is. Right? You lower the interest rate. That makes a lot of these investments look like they make sense. But then once the interest rate rises again, it's obvious that these investments were a bad idea. So we were bribed into doing something that didn't actually make sense. An additional argument that actually I think ties in with this argument very, very well suggests that there's a conflict between the social interest in terms of entrepreneurs and their private interests. To really get at this idea, I think it's worth noting that Mises himself actually suggested that if entrepreneurs get good enough foresight about the way credit expansion works, then we're not going to see a boom bust anymore. He suggests this actually a couple times. If you look, he kind of hints at it in The Theory of Money and Credit when he talks about inflation and inflationism. He says, well, if the time ever came that people really fully understood the effects of inflation, then we'd see a lot of the effects on output in particular disappear. That wouldn't happen. And he says almost exactly the same thing in National Economy, but applying it specifically to credit expansion. If the time ever came that businessmen really understood the effects of credit expansion, they would say, in effect, what's the point of going through this whole thing? Okay, this boom happens, but then it's going to collapse. And we actually know, as Dr. Garrison points out, when it collapses, we end up at a point where we're worse than when we started. So let's not participate at all. Let's act as if this credit expansion is not happening. So what this argument would say is, well, now it may be true that the group of entrepreneurs, or the group of all of us in the economy, for that matter, is better off if we don't participate in the credit expansion. We just tell the banks to keep their filthy money, and we just go on as if it didn't happen. Let's set aside all the complications of actually knowing what it would look like without credit expansion. Let's just set that aside for now. This argument would say, well, it's true, socially this is the right thing to do, but still, from an individual perspective, I as an individual entrepreneur am not going to cause a business cycle for everybody. I'm one little guy in the entire market. So it's really tempting to me to accept this bribe and to make some profits along the way. And because we don't get this huge business cycle, we're not going to get a huge crash, and I'll probably be okay. But it ends up, if everybody faces exactly the same incentive, has exactly the same bribe offered to them, they end up accepting this deal. So we end up, even though socially it's not the best thing for us as a group to do, we each are making our own decisions. And this leads us into a potential situation that isn't particularly good for any of us. Now, I have some responses to that based on my criticism of game theory, but you can come see that. I believe it's tomorrow. So, okay. Now, one point that I would say here is that I think that both of these arguments work reasonably well in the early stages of the boom. In the early stages of the boom, like even reasonably good entrepreneurs are going to say, well, you know what? Even though I know that the bust will eventually come, the crisis will come, everything will collapse, there's time before that happens. And so there's room for me, say, here, to buy a house, to flip it, and to make money. And so even reasonably good entrepreneurs might hop in early on, right, accepting this bribe. But I'd suggest these explanations don't work as well the closer we get to the peak. Because the closer we get to the peak, the more our really good entrepreneurs are going to say, the odds of me getting out before things collapse are not very good. So now we need an explanation for how is it we actually get to the peak. There, I would suggest the answer, or at least one of the potential answers, the one that I like, is that we have heterogeneous entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs, I think that's right. The idea here being, right, we know that capital is heterogeneous. Right? You cannot go to McDonald's and order a BMW. They just can't make it. They don't have the right equipment to do this. Right? It ends up, I would say, that entrepreneurs are heterogeneous in terms of their quality. Right? There are some people that are very, very good entrepreneurs, that have very, very good foresight, are very good at figuring out what's going to happen in the markets in the future. I think Warren Buffett, despite his unfortunate political leanings at times, tends to be one of these people. He's very, very good at identifying what types of investments are going to do well when. But at the other end, we have people who are horrible entrepreneurs, who wouldn't know a good investment if it walked up and slapped them in the face, because they have awful foresight. They have no way of telling, and they're not very good at telling. In fact, they make bad guesses about what's going to happen in the future. As an example, I would offer myself. I could pull up, I'm honest with this. I have an Ameritrade account that I opened when I was in college. I decided, I'm an economics major. I can win. And I had something even worse, in that when I first got started investing, I was actually in like seventh grade, I think it was. And I got started investing because I had acne, actually. Funny story, I went to my dermatologist. He said, I paid for medical school with IBM stock. At the time, I was thinking I was going to go to law school. I should have known by now that I don't have good foresight. That's not what happened. Right? At the time, I was planning to go to law school. I thought, I'm going to have to pay for this. I need to get started investing. It so happened that time was right around the mid-90s. And the mid-90s were a great time to get started investing. Right? So I bought this stock. It was called AirTouch Communications. Somebody actually remembers AirTouch. Yeah, AirTouch got bought up by another company, then turned, eventually became Verizon. So I bought this stock. Within a year, I doubled my money. So now eighth grade, not then, but eventual Dr. Engelhardt knows, I'm an awesome investor. Obviously, I can do this. So when I'm starting investing in college right after the tech bubble burst, I know I have a track record. I'm an awesome investor. Unlike all those other dupes in the 90s, I made money. Of course, we know that in the 90s, everybody, regardless of how dupish you were, made money. Okay. So what happened with this account? I opened this account with Ameritrade. I put a couple thousand dollars into it. Today, that account stands at $1.19. I lost that money pretty fast because I bought companies and they went bankrupt. I bought this company and I was intentionally taking lots of risk. It ends up, things don't work out when you take lots of risk a lot of the time. And so I lost virtually everything. So I keep that account. It's kind of my reminder that there's a difference between somebody who's a good economist and somebody who's a good entrepreneur. I hope. Or there's very little hope for me. Okay. All right. So there's heterogeneous entrepreneurs. On the one hand, we have Warren Buffett. On the other hand, we have me. So when we, say, have financial markets or are funding various investment projects, who does that money go to? There's only a limited amount of savings available. Right? And if financial markets do their job right, it's going to tend to get steered toward the really good entrepreneurs. So we're going to tend to see that those businesses that actually start do tend to succeed. Right? Profits will be a normal thing because we're ultimately giving the resources to those entrepreneurs who are good at it. And if we allow market processes to work in terms of profit and loss, there's a natural sorting that will go on. And those entrepreneurs that happen to get money anyway, despite the fact they're bad at it, are going to lose it. The $2,000 will turn into $1.19, and at that point, you're out of the market. Okay. Right. So that's the way things should naturally work. We have entrepreneurs who are really good at it are the ones that get funding. But I would suggest that over the course of the business cycle, as the boom goes on, we have two things happen. First, the credit expansion expands the number of entrepreneurs, and therefore the quality of entrepreneurs, that can secure funding. Right? So we've already funded all the really good guys for the really good projects. The only people left are projects that are either riskier or offer a lower return. Right? So we draw in these entrepreneurs or these projects, right, that aren't quite as good as those we had in before. And I'd suggest, right, so early on, we have this process happening. There's more credit available. We end up funding more investment. A lot of this investment goes to lousy entrepreneurs. Maybe not lousy entrepreneurs, but middling entrepreneurs. But as the business cycle goes on, I'd suggest that those really good entrepreneurs that see the end coming start to back out. So you can imagine, suppose that we have, I don't like continuums because they cover up a lot, but I'll draw one anyway. All right, so here we have Warren Buffett on the one hand. Here's Dr. Engelhardt on the other. I'm definitely the extreme lower end. And during normal times, we'd have, say, this set of entrepreneurs all get funding. They're all reasonably high quality. Credit expansion will, in turn, add in a few more entrepreneurs that aren't quite as good. Their foresight isn't quite as good. But then as the business cycle moves on, Warren Buffett starts to back out. The people that are very similar to Warren Buffett start to back out. Yet we still have all this funding flowing into the markets. So who does it go to? Well, it goes to the best entrepreneurs available. Right? So we have, say, roughly this many can get it. So I'll go down. So you end up with this set of entrepreneurs that get funding. So over the course of the business cycle, there's a systematic decrease in the quality of the entrepreneurs that are actually in the market. Because, first, we have more funding available, drawing in these low quality. And second, those entrepreneurs that are really good start to back out at right about the right time, leaving only the dolts in the market. So here, kind of this theory of error isn't so much saying that entrepreneurs who are normally very good at what they do become idiots during the business cycle. No, this is actually reversing that, saying that during the business cycle, idiots become empowered to become entrepreneurs. And we can see this happening, right? Like, who, after all, was buying houses during the housing boom? The answer was basically everybody except Peter Schiff. Right? People, oh, first-time home buyers were great for this, right? And they loved buying houses because they're sure, right, at this moment, oh, look at what housing prices have done. They're going to keep going up forever. 10, 20% a year. Well, no, obviously not. Right? Obvious to the really good entrepreneurs, not to those that aren't. Okay. So that's kind of a potential explanation for how is it that we end up with so much error that happens over the business cycle. One thing I'd note is that these types of explanations are things that we can get in our Austrian business cycle theory that I don't know that we see as much with, say, rational expectations. We don't get that kind of story here. It's not as rich in their story. So what have we shown so far? Right, first, that the business cycle has to have errors involved with it. Right? It doesn't make sense for us to make investments that aren't going to turn out if we know that they're not going to turn out. And secondly, we've given a few explanations for why is it that we see these errors get made. All right. So errors get made over the business cycle. Then the crisis comes. And I think it's very accurate. I really like the way that Dr. Holzman says this. He wrote an article, I believe it was in 98, toward a general theory of error cycles, in which he totally condemns everything I just did here. He's not here, so that's okay. At least I don't see him in the room. All right. You want to make sure you never criticize him while he's in the room. All right, so he would condemn all this, and he says, no, okay. But one thing that he does say, and I think he says it very, very well, is that any business cycle theory is a theory of error, and the crisis comes when those errors get revealed. It's not, this is not original to him, but I really like the way he said it in that article. Okay, so the crisis comes when we realize, no, in fact, everything that we were built upon here is a foundation of sand. It's all not going to be stable. Everything's going to eventually collapse. These were, in fact, bad investments. How exactly this gets revealed, to a certain degree, depends on which scholar you read. If you read, say, Murray Rothbard's story that he tells in Manicharmian State, which is, I think, probably my preferred version, the story he tells is a little bit different from the way that Mises tells it. And I don't think it's that they're conflicting stories. They're just capturing different elements of what's going on in terms of what brings about the necessity of the crisis. I'm not going to talk too much about either of those. Right. We'll just accept. Eventually, the crisis happens. Right? We cannot be in error forever. Right? Just in a rather silly example, right? What is an error? An error is any time that I have an ends and try to use the wrong means to attain that ends. Right? So it ends up that from Northeast Ohio, I was flying down to Atlanta. One thing that I could have done was go out to my front lawn and flap my arms wildly and then land in Atlanta and hop on the shuttle to come here. It shouldn't take me very long flapping my arms to realize this is not a good plan. Right? My means are not going to help me attain my ends. Right? Eventually, this is going to get revealed. Now, it ends up in an economy as complex as ours, it might take quite a while for us to figure that out. We're not all just flapping our arms and then the crash comes. There's lots of things happening that we may not be clear, but eventually the crisis will come. All right. So the crisis comes. We realize we've made all of these bad investments. We've built a bunch of lead baseball factories, despite the fact that nobody actually wants lead baseballs. So now the question is, what happens? Well, it ends up all of these horrible investments we made lose significant value. It's not so much that they lose value as that their price reflects the value that it should have been in the first place. It's not that these lead baseball factories actually were valuable at some point in time. No, rather there was a lie happening in the market. Interest rates were lying to us, or in this case, the subsidy was lying to us, right, about the value of this thing. Right? And then we realize, oh, no, actually, that's not what the value was. It should be something else. Right? So these lead baseball factories end up drastically reducing their value, at least in that use. And we have to repurpose things. Okay, these workers, they probably shouldn't be making lead baseballs, so we need to retrain them to do something else. Ideally, we'd retrain them to do something somewhat related that'd minimize how much loss we've had. But at the same time, that doesn't take away the fact that we are, in fact, poor. We took a bunch of resources, a bunch of worker time, a bunch of workers, a bunch of materials out of other forms of production that could have produced something that people would actually want, and we've used them to produce lead baseballs. Or in the course of the business cycle, we've used them in early stages of production or building houses, things that are, in the end, not particularly valuable. So we need to take all these people and we need to retrain them. That's where I heard a question came up yesterday in terms of, well, how is it that we get out of this crash? Well, it's this repurposing process. We find, okay, we're stuck with this factory. Now we could just kind of ignore it. Or probably the better thing to do would be think of something we can do with it. Now let's talk about government stimulus. Because government stimulus takes a totally different approach to how we deal with the crisis. Okay, so this is where often I find, at least for me, it's kind of fun to be an Austrian economist during the boom. Because right? There everything's going well, and you get to be the person saying, oh no, it's going to crash, it's going to crash. And kind of laughing inside, knowing that you're right. And you're proven right. Right? The day eventually comes, where even if you're a lousy entrepreneur like me and you have no clue when the crisis is going to come, I at least know that it's coming. I might call it early, oh well. But I eventually am proven right. Okay, that makes you feel good. I believe that most academics exist to be proven right. It's the main purpose of what we do. If it weren't, I would not have become an academic. I could have made more money doing something else. Okay, but I get to be proven right, and that's awesome. But it's very frustrating to be an academic an Austrian economist during the course of the bust. Because here you get to be right again, but you don't get to be proven right. Because what happens? Well, bust is happening. This is very unpleasant. People are losing their jobs. People are finding their houses decrease in value. People are finding their retirement portfolios lose value rapidly. And we come up with the great phrase, and great because of its vagueness, we have to do something. And this is, I think, vague on either end, right? Who is we? Almost always, what we mean by we is the government has to do something. Right? So it could be Congress, it could be Ben Bernanke at the Fed, and we can debate on, is it government or not, doesn't matter, it's a government-like institution. Right? We need these people in authority. Right? They need to do something about this. Right? What do they need to do? Come up with a plan. Right? So, okay, who has a plan for how to fix the economy? We start flipping through books, and we flip way back to the 1930s. Ah! Right? Here we have John Maynard Keynes. He has a great playbook for us. what do? We need to push down interest rates. That will try to stimulate more investment. That's a good thing, right? After all, output is measured as consumption plus investment plus government spending. Pushing up investment, that's a good thing. We'll recover the economy. Right? We also have government spending in there. The government needs to go out and spend a bunch of money. Interestingly, this is often not actually the way that things are framed when you hear a politician speak. They don't talk about increasing GDP. They talk about jobs. The problem is we don't have any jobs. We need to produce jobs. We're going to make, or we're going to create or save jobs. Jobs. Right? It wouldn't be so bad if they were talking about, say, Steve Jobs doing things like creating jobs. No, that's not what they mean. I mean, no, we're going to do something that's going to create jobs. Now, anybody who's a little bit reflective should notice that it's never your problem that you don't have a job. I would be perfectly content to sit in my living room all day, watching Glee. Preferences are subjective. Don't judge me. Okay. All right, so I'm watching Glee, or Phineas and Ferb, great Disney shows. Yeah. Sometimes I confess too much in my lectures. Right, so I'd be perfectly happy to do this as long as I could get everything that I wanted and needed. Right? So in a paradise, I'm sitting there, my wife next to me, we're watching Glee, or watching Phineas and Ferb, what have you. I don't know, our son is there in the room, sitting down. We don't let him watch TV, he's only 5 months old, so he's facing us. And we enjoy the baby sounds, right? This is perfect. And then I think, I want a ham sandwich. Nobody yet has revealed this to you, but it's actually in our contract. We have to mention a ham sandwich at some point. So I have my check mark there. Okay. I'm watching the others to know who we should dock pay. All right, so I want a ham sandwich. How does this work in a perfect world? Some might suggest, well, the ham sandwich just appears right there in my lap. But I'm lazy. I honestly don't believe I've ever stepped into a real gym in my life. Minimize physical effort as much as possible. In my lap, that's too far from my mouth. Right? In front of, floating in the air in front of my mouth, no. That's too far from in my mouth. Right? In my mouth, there, that's too far from my stomach. No, I want to have that ham sandwich already digested. Especially because I actually don't like ham. Right. So actually, what would this perfect world be like? Right? It's one where any time that a need would arise, it would immediately be fulfilled. To the point where I don't even necessarily notice the need arise. Wow. That's a perfect world. And in this world, do I work? Well, not in the conventional sense. Right now, I might spend time doing things I enjoy. For example, I might still give economics lectures. But because everybody else is doing things they enjoy, nobody would come. But that's okay, right? I enjoy giving lectures in my empty hotel room. It's something I enjoy doing, so I'll do it anyway. But it's not really work, because I enjoy it. It has consumption value for me. So it ends up that I'm perpetrating a great scam in that I'm actually getting paid to do this, right? But it ends up, with my job as a professor, the part that they actually pay me to do is grade. Grading papers is terrible. You think writing them is bad? Right? Try grading them? Horrible. Absolutely horrible. Okay. All right, so that's what they pay me to do. That's the unpleasant part of my job that I do because they pay me. Right? And that's what work is. It's something unpleasant you do because you are being paid, and that payment will help you do something else that you want to do. Right? Help me pay my rent, that kind of thing. Or help me pay for Netflix so I can watch Phineas and Ferb all that I want. Right? Okay. All right, so the problem isn't a lack of jobs. No, we could have a world, at least we could imagine a perfect world. In that perfect world, nobody really has a job. We all just enjoy leisure, whatever that happens to look like for each of us. So what's the real problem? The real problem isn't a lack of jobs, it's just this lack of income. That's what I'm perceiving. And if I still had the same income, despite the fact that I didn't have a job, I would actually be much happier. I would have more leisure, and I'd also have as many material belongings as I had before. So it's not the lack of jobs, it's the lack of income. So when we take this perspective and we start evaluating government policy, we find out it's absolutely idiotic what they're doing. So we think about, say, one of the programs that was suggested in the most recent recession here in the United States was, well, we're going to have an $800 billion stimulus program. And according to all of our great economic estimates, thanks to Christina Romer and others, we know we're going to save or create or save. Save is a sneaky word, isn't it? Right? create or save 3 to 4 million jobs. And now it ends up, for most people, this will fool them, because most people, as soon as you end a word with illion, they have no idea what the beginning of the word was, right? So, oh, right, okay, we're spending 800 illion to create 4 illion. That's pretty good, right? That's just what, $200 a piece. That's an awesome deal, right? But no, it's not, right? Anybody who knows what the word begins with knows that we're actually spending $200,000 for each job we're creating or saving. How much of that $200,000 is turning into income for these 3 to 4 million people whose jobs are being saved? My guess is not much. Which means if our real purpose is to create or save jobs, we're doing an awful job of it. Awful job of it. It's confusing. We're not doing it very well. In fact, at the time that they were debating this, I made a blog post. I have a very lightly visited blog. And I said, hey, you know, if the real purpose is to create jobs, I can, in fact, solve our unemployment problems right now with exactly that amount of money. Right? Take that $800 billion, divide it up between 16 million people, roughly the number that are unemployed right now, pay each of them $50,000 to sit at home and watch TV for a year. $50,000, it ends up, is a pretty good income, right? That's only slightly less than the median income in the United States for a household. Not for a worker, for a household. That's a pretty good income to be paid to sit there and watch TV. And we could provide 16 million of these kinds of jobs. But it ends up that the politicians don't do that. They only create 3 or 4 million with exactly that same money. Okay, so what's going on? Well, it ends up that despite their rhetoric, politicians actually know what the economy is for. They understand. What is the real economic problem? It's that we have these needs that we want to have fulfilled. We have various means available to us to fulfill them, and we want to use these means to fulfill those needs. So it's all about taking our resources and using them well. So politicians kind of vaguely understand this. They often forget the well part. Right? We have these resources. We need to use them to produce something that might potentially have value. But we need to produce something. So it's not actually about jobs. It's about production. So what do they do? They say, well, we're going to go out, we're going to rebuild crumbling roads and bridges. Those are my favorite phrases coming from President Obama. Crumbling roads and bridges. It's a nice ring to it. We're going to repair crumbling roads and bridges. We're going to take extra money and we're going to bail out the banks. What are all these things actually designed to do, right? It's ultimately designed to create some kind of production. Okay. So here's where I think it's actually okay of us to some degree, to acknowledge that this type of government stimulus very well might increase GDP. We might end up with more consumption. We might end up with more investment. What it will not increase is our well-being. Why? Well, we know we've made these errors. Let's go back to lead baseballs. We've created these lead baseball factories that are now sitting empty. We have all these workers trained to produce lead baseballs that now don't have a job. So if I want to create something, I want to bring something into production, and I want this to be a project that is shovel-ready, another great phrase, right? Something that we can bring online very, very fast to get an immediate boost in GDP, what do? Well, I start buying lead baseballs. The government steps in and says, okay, well, let's start buying up lead baseballs that will bring all these factories that we already have back into production. It will bring all of these workers that we already have, who already have the skill sets we need to do this, we'll give them their jobs back. Oh, we'll save those jobs. And we end up producing lead baseballs. These lead baseballs show up either in consumption if we can convince people to buy it for something. Probably not. It'll probably show up in government spending. These are government purchases, and we have warehouses full of surplus lead baseballs. Okay. So let's put all this together. Why is government spending such a bad idea in the Austrian theory? It's because it's going to be most effective in what the government's real goal is, that is increasing production. It's going to be most effective at that if we resurrect all these awful investments that we made during the boom. That's how we're going to have the easiest time stimulating the economy. That's exactly what we don't want to do. As long as we keep running these lead baseball factories, we have people that are building skills in that area and no other areas. They're becoming more and more useless in something that might actually serve consumers. As long as we keep pouring lead into these factories, it's lead not going somewhere else or might be useful. As long as we keep investing in keeping these factories running in terms of maintenance, that kind of thing, those are resources going into these factories, that are not particularly useful in serving consumers. So in fact, we're being made poor every time that we try to keep these factories running. So as long as we, I think the right word is we just paper over all these errors. And that allows these errors to continue. And as long as these errors continue, we're in fact getting poorer. All right. So I think, that basically wraps up. So just summing everything up. We know error has to be part of the business cycle. We need it in there. Austrians can provide reasonably good explanations for why we see error and why it becomes a huge problem over the course of the boom. And in the bust, the exact wrong thing for us to do is for us to try to stimulate those investments that were in error. Yet that's exactly what the government's going to try to do when they try to stimulate the economy. All right, thanks.